What's up, Disrupt Nation? My name is Tony Delgado, and today we have a super special guest, Mr. Brad Blazer. Brad, thanks so much for being on the show, my friend.
It's a pleasure, buddy. It's a pleasure.
So you're the CEO and founder of Capital School. You are a speaker, a best-selling author, and you're known as the $2 billion man.
Two billies.
So before we dive into your backstory and how you got started, tell us, how did you get the title, the $2 billion man?
Well, over the course of my career, I've worked for some of the world's largest financial services firms, worked for some of the biggest real estate syndicators here. And looking back, I've raised well over $2 billion in capital through my efforts and the efforts of teams I've led. So people just gave me that title. It sounds good. I like it. So they call me the $2 billion guy.
So we just got back from the Mastermind in Paradise on the Dominican Republic, right?
Yeah.
And we're on the private jet, we're chatting, and I was like, oh my God, this is too much fire. We got to go to the studio and shoot a podcast. So here we are, it's like almost midnight, and we're recording. I want to get a little bit, before we talk about all the things you're doing now, because you're doing some exciting things, you're helping people raise capital and basically start their own hedge funds, right? But before we dive into that, how did you get started? Were you born with like a silver spoon in your mouth?
Fuck no.
And
were you
born on a private jet? Or?
No, I was born, you know, traditional middle class family, you know, mom and dad, you know. My dad was an executive. I mean, we did well. You know, we had, I guess what you'd call kind of an upper middle class lifestyle. My mom was a stay-at-home mom until all the kids were at an age where she could go get a job as a real estate agent. But, you know, the funny thing is you look at, you know, Robert Kiyosaki, who, of course, wrote the book Rich Dad, Poor Dad. In my life, I did have a rich uncle, and it was my Uncle Henry. And, you know, he never had more than a sixth-grade education. Grew up working in New York, responsible for looking after his two sisters. And he went to work basically in New York City in the textile industry. And so he met a guy that had some capital. And for whatever reason, they struck up a friendship, much like the two of us. And the guy with the money said, Henry, man, you know, you're a smart guy. I'd love to partner with you. And so they started the company. And it became one of the top women's fashion brands back in, you know, the 20s, 30s, 40s. They sold the company for millions of dollars. And I always said to myself, man, I want to be like him. Like, he's got the Rolls Royce, he's got the chauffeur, he's got the house in Scarsdale, he's got the place in Palm Beach. Like, I knew his life was better than our life.
Yeah.
But I remember him saying something to me when I was about 7 years old. We were at the Palm Beach Country Club, and it was right after Thanksgiving. And he was kind of walking me around after dinner, and he said, you see that guy over there? And I'm like, yeah. That was a real impressionist. That guy makes all the erasers at the end of your pencils in school. Oh, you see this guy? Guy makes all the hangers. I'm like, oh, that's cool, man. And then he put his hand on my shoulder. And this is what I call kind of a revelation. In life, I personally believe that people will plant seeds in you that will awaken themselves later in life. And you don't know really where that spark comes from. But he said, if you can figure out at some point what you're really gifted at, where it can help change other people's lives and deliver it to the world, it's a real magical thing. And so, you know, you flash forward fucking 40 years. I'm sitting here now at a point in my career, built successful companies, and I was watching Steve Harvey on TV. And Steve Harvey was on stage, and he said to his entire audience, I believe everybody here in the room in my audience has unique talent. I call it your something special. It's like if you ever been to that little Build-A-Bear factory with the kids, and they put that little heart in the bear, it's in you. But he said, here's the sad thing. Most people will never figure out what it is. 97% of you will never figure out what that unique talent is. But for those 3% that can figure that shit out and create content, create a business, and deliver it to the world, it'll change your life. He said, that's why most people are unhappy at what they do. They're not living in the zone. And so literally, I still remember the day vividly. I was on my patio. I live in a beautiful country club, smoking a cigar, drinking a bourbon. And it hit me, and I said, oh, my fucking God, my talent is I know how to raise capital. I've raised millions, more than anybody I've ever met, and I can teach other people how to do that. It solves the biggest problem for business owners and entrepreneurs around the world. Like, everybody needs access to money, right?
Yeah.
And you go to the bank, you get turned down because you get shitty credit or your business doesn't have the numbers the banker's looking for, and you're sitting there going, well, I guess I'm stuck. No, you're fucking not stuck. You're surrounded every day by all the money you need. We call all those other people investors.
Yeah.
And so I created this platform that today has just blossomed to a global platform teaching people all over the world. And the cool thing is the people are having success, raising money. My top student last year, over $100 million. Wow. That's life-changing money for his business. And so, you know, we're just real humbled, real blessed. Great to connect with you. But that's largely what we do is we teach people three things. How to attract the attention of potential investors. We impart the knowledge as to what to say to those people. And then thirdly, we got people that have already been successful. Now they want to launch a fund or really scale their business, and we take them to that next level.
So how important is it, is integrity and mindset and, you know, going into things with some of the soft skills that might be required versus the legal? Because I know you help with that too. You help with the legal and all the technical aspects of raising money. But how much is it the soft skills that matter? And what are those soft skills that people need?
So it's a great question. It's definitely a lot of mindset. You know, you got to be confident, obviously, in what you're doing. But what I've been able to do, which I think makes me a little bit more successful maybe than others, is, you know, I've been doing this for 35 years. And so I've got a lot of knowledge up here. Everything I've done right, everything I've done wrong. And I've been able to codify that and create what I call core concepts. So when I consult or I mentor somebody, I'm like, look, we're going to talk about key concepts. Because if you can grasp this concept and apply it to what you're doing in your business, I guarantee you'll have success. I mean, I'll put it in writing. And so we talk about things like the four-step blueprint, the trust sequence, the validation phrase. And these are things that once somebody understands what that is and applies it, they'll have tremendous success. So for the four-step blueprint, and Jordan Belfort, the Wolf of Wall Street, calls it the straight line method, same approach. It is not a script, but it's an understanding that you need to build trust. You asked about integrity. You know, you're building trust. It's kind of like dating a girl. I mean, you know, most people don't marry the first girl that hops in bed. You go out on a date, you get to know her, there's a courtship, right? Same thing with investors. Like, you know, the biggest problem most people have is they have a deal or they have a project. They see someone that they know has money. And like on the first date, you're telling them about the deal, and what they're going to say is, oh, Tony, it sounds pretty exciting. Like, do you have something that you can send me so I can take a look at it? And you do. You think there's like dinner in it. And so you send everything and then you try to close them and you get every excuse we've ever heard. But really what that person is saying is you didn't give me enough time to really get to know you.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, I don't really know your values. I don't know that you're going to treat me as a fiduciary and treat my money as if it was your money. Like, if you would just slow down the process to let me feel more comfortable in this relationship, I'd probably be more apt to open my checkbook and move forward. And so when we teach people that that is probably what you're doing wrong, let's slow it down, spend some time with people, allow them to know you, they go, this works. Like, I'm having great success. I'm converting more people are investing. I'm like, yeah, of course it works. I've been doing it for 30 years. I've raised millions of dollars and so have other people. But then it gets to integrity. And here's something I think that is really true in this world. I think that the people like the Madoffs or anybody that gets caught doing something wrong in the investment world does not just wake up someday and go, I'm going to screw everybody. I'm just going to create a Ponzi scheme. I don't think that's what happens. I think what happens is they build a business and they get out over the end of their skis. Either the business grows too fast and they get sloppy or whatever, and then they're like, oh, shit, we're making mistakes. And they try to sweep that shit under the rug.
I'll work harder and try to fix it.
And then they get caught. And so then they're screwed.
Yeah.
But I don't think anybody intentionally goes into the world saying, I want to start a business to screw people. I think that they get out too far, they do something wrong, and they realize we made a mistake, they try to hide it. That's the wrong thing to do. I was in the oil business where there is a real risk. You're going to drill a dry hole. It's like being a surgeon and going to the operating room and doing everything you can, but the patient dies. And so how hard is it to go to somebody and say, thank you so much for investing $500,000. It's down the toilet and you lost it all. But you got to do it.
Well, yeah, it's almost the equivalent of the doctor trying to hide the body. No, your mom's doing fine. She's on the West Wing. We just can't let you see her yet.
But, you know, when I was in oil, whenever we had a marginal well or something didn't work out, I was honest, I was transparent, and people would continue to invest.
Mm-hmm. Even like, when you lost some. Because you win some, you lose some, right?
And I'm like, look, I just lost $100,000 for you. Like, why are you re-upping and investing again? And I always get the same answer. It's because we know you're a guy of integrity. You're totally transparent. We know you use the best of the best. You're using companies like Schlumberger, Halliburton, Baker Hughes, the biggest in the world. but it's because you're honest and you're transparent. There's a lot of people out here, Brad, that would try to cover that shit up and draw it out. Oh, well, you know, we're doing this to the well and we're trying to do this. And, you know, 6 months later, I learn the truth. You're just totally transparent.
Yeah.
And in the world where you're dealing with people's money, man, integrity is everything. Like my grandfather told me, once you lose your good name in the world, you're done. Mm. Your name stands for everything. And so once people look at you and go, oh, he's a fraud, or, you know, he's misleading people, or he's dishonest, you're fucked. And so when you realize that integrity is everything, whether you're raising money or not, but in business in general, people want to do business with people they can trust.
Yeah.
That's what it comes down to.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that I've learned as I'm moving in different rooms, yeah, right? Getting in higher level rooms and higher level situations. I've just noticed that people that are making the most money are operating at extremely high levels of integrity.
Oh, absolutely.
It's you know, it's almost, I'm almost in awe of the level of integrity. For example, even on this trip, right? Yeah. The guy who financed the trip, yeah, forgot his passport and got stuck at the airport, and he was the most humble about it, the most, yeah, cool, chill. You guys go yeah, to the beach, yeah, go have fun. And I'm, yeah, like, I'd be a little pissed, I think, if I forgot my passport. And
swearing at, yeah, the costume.
And he said, you know what he said? He said it was God's plan. He's like, this is God's plan because I want to meet the politicians and I needed a lawyer anyway. So now I have a lawyer instead of, oh, geez, I got to hire a lawyer.
The funny thing is he's going back in a couple of weeks. And who's he meeting with? The former president of the entire country.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. You know, so yeah. Sometimes, yeah, things work out in your favor. You know, sometimes they don't. But, you know, in this case, yeah, the guy spent 3 days in an airport with customs and immigration officers, and 3 weeks later, he's, you know, meeting now the former president of the entire country.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, and turning your pain into passion, turning your problems into opportunities, yep, right? So in your career of investing, do you have any stories, crazy stories of things going wrong, and and how, if at all, you able to make them right?
Yeah, so, you know, I mean, I've lost money, I've made money, and, you know, you look back over your entire investment career, and you kind of ask yourself, like, what could I have done better? You know, back in the 80s, the tax structure was very different than it was today. And so people that were investing in real estate would say, look, you know, if you want to invest with us, what you're going to do is you're going to sign a promissory note. And you're going to, you know, put in a little bit of money, but you're going to commit to a larger amount of money, and it's paid in installments. And the tax structure back in 87, 88 was very different than today. So you could literally write off 2-3 times the amount that you were invested, which means if you invested 100, you would get a tax statement at the end of the year that said you had actually invested 300. So you're getting a $300,000 tax savings on a $100,000 investment. But here's the deal. If the thing didn't work out, it came back and it bit you in the ass, and it was called phantom income. Now you got to pay taxes on money that you never earned because you got the benefit of that huge deduction. And so I invested in this real estate syndication, and all of a sudden, of course, the real estate market crashed. It was in a beautiful apartment community, you know, down in Houston, 300 and some odd units with one of the biggest developers. You know, great guy, totally legit, but just, you know, invested at the wrong time. The market went against us, and I got a fucking tax bill. I'm like, I got to pay taxes on $300,000. I didn't even fucking earn the money. Like, how do I find the money to pay the taxes? And so, you know, you just kind of figure it out. You know, you're either going to negotiate with the IRS. I got a really good tax attorney, and things didn't work out. But it is what it is, you know.
Yeah.
And here's the thing I'll tell everybody that's a listener of yours. Never go into an investment for the tax benefits. Go into it for the economics. If it makes sense and you understand it, move forward. I can't tell you how many people I've consulted with and consoled that said, yeah, I invested in Forex. I'm like, did you understand it? Fuck no, but it sounded great. And of course, they lose everything, you know? Yeah. I put some money into crypto and then the wallet just evaporated. My money disappeared. Like, did you understand it? No, but it sounded great. If you don't understand the fundamentals of what you're putting your money into, you probably don't want to do it. But people do, you know? And I tell them, you know, you got to realize, like Warren Buffett says, the easiest way to double your money is fold it in half and stick it in your pocket. But it's true. You know, the big secret to building wealth is to not to lose your money. And people don't realize, you know, in the stock market, they say, look, if your portfolio drops 20%, it's now got to do 40% just to get you back to where you were. You know, it's not as simple as, you know, people think it is. And sometimes it does take a long time to just recover and get back to where you were. But, you know, today I love real estate. Of course, we're doing stuff there. Of course, we love the stock market. We've talked about that. I was in crypto, probably going to get back in crypto because Bitcoin's going to be halving again here in a couple months. And, you know, you look at the four-year thing that people talk about with the crypto world. But it's really all about understanding, like Grant Cardone says, and I love Grant, money is nothing more than a tool. It really is. And once you understand that it's a tool and it needs to be put to work, you know, you're able to create legacy wealth. Most people get to a point in life where they have a little bit of money in the bank, and then they're thinking, well, if I lose it, I can't replenish it. That's what I call basically a scarcity mindset. No, you got to have an abundance mindset. Man, I'm putting my money here, and I'm putting my money here, and I'm circulating it, and if I lose it, I can earn it back. People that have that shift and that mentality are the ones that go on to accumulate tremendous success in life. Those that have that scarcity mindset, you know, they might accumulate a little bit of money, but they're never going to be the ones that really do big things.
What do investors look for, right? Like, let's say you're a startup. We have a lot of startups that watch our show. You know, myself personally used to work at an angel investment firm, mm-hmm. and we used to see a million pitch decks per week. What do investors look for, right? I know you started out the show talking about how you can kind of smell the desperation on certain startup founders where they're just like, hey, I'm going to build the next Google, and when you're going to write me that check, right?
Yeah.
What are investors looking for?
I think more than anything else, they're really looking to the person or the people that are behind the deal or whatever it is. I mean, I get people saying, oh, I need to have a track record, or I'm too young, or, you know, I'm a person of color. I mean, I had a guy the other day that I was talking to about joining our program, and then he just said, you know, I got to ask you a question and don't get offended. He's like, can I do this as a person of color? I just said, I'm like, I got Chinese people, I got Hispanic people, I got Asian people, I got African-American people that are the same color as you. I'm like, don't let that be the impediment, because right now you've already self-sabotaged your success because of that limiting belief.
Well, and not only can you do it, in fact, that could be your advantage. That could be your thing.
Exactly.
Like, you know, I'm Indian, I raise money from other Indians. You know, I'm black, I raise money from the black community.
I said,
you know,
how many African American doctors are there in the United States? Hundreds. I said, how many business owners are African American? Hundreds. You know, I said, let that be your niche.
Yeah.
But he'd already self-sabotaged to some degree. And I said, look, you know, as a coach, I got to help you overcome that limiting belief.
Yeah.
But the thing really, I think about all of this thing with raising money is it's really confidence. It's building what I call your power team, or as Mark Cuban would say, it's the difference between being an entrepreneur and a solopreneur. I mean, we've all started businesses. You're spinning every play. You're answering phones. You're doing everything. People that invest want to see a little bit of depth. So what I mean by that is, you know, find a local attorney and be able to say, you know, hey, we got Tony as our securities attorney. He's going to make sure we stay out of trouble. I got Bobby over here who's a partner at a CPA firm. He's going to do your taxes at the end of the year. I got this guy over here that's going to handle this aspect. And you start realizing that the investor's like, well, this guy gets it. Like, he understands the fundamentals of the business. But people always say, oh, I need a track record. I was a 23-year-old fucking college dropout that had never drilled an oil well that built a multi-million-dollar company. Why? Because I was a cocky little kid. I was confident. I'd get on the phone and I'd tell people, I got an attorney, I got a CPA, we got a petroleum land end. And people were tossing money at me at 23, and I was driving a little sports car around town, had a nice house. So I'm telling people, it's really about the deal. It's about, you know, you. It's about the team, because people invest in other people. It's really a relationship-driven business that it really comes down to just building that relationship, building that trust. You know, does the deal have to make sense? Yeah, sure it does. But at the end of the day, if you can be honest and slow down the process and really get that other person to understand the economics, understand the deal, and more importantly, know a little bit about you and your team, you can raise a ton of money.
Yeah.
And we get students that are literally in their 20s that are now, you know, managing 40, 60, 80 million dollar real estate portfolios. And it's mind-boggling to think this kid's 28, he's managing a $60 million real estate portfolio. 28 years old. So I tell people, anybody can do this, you know. When I was in the oil business, a real story. I was looking to hire a guy to come on my team. And I want all your listeners to imagine, because this is a funny story. We're in a very prestigious office building in Austin, Texas. I got the whole third floor. Everybody in the building is pretty much a suit. You know, suit and tie or a sports coat, professional, you know, big law firms, CPA firms, brokerage firms. This guy comes in for an interview, and literally he looks like Joe Dirt. He's got a mullet for a haircut, you know, big old Fu Manchu mustache, had jeans with holes in the knees, flannel shirt, you know, dirt on his boots. Now, for most people coming into a corporate environment to interview dressed like that, the interview would have ended at the front door.
Yeah.
But, you know, kind of person, come on in, Jack. You want a cup of coffee? And so as I was interviewing him, I asked him a question that literally changed his life. I said, why do you want to come work for me? And he looked at me with a stare that pierced my heart. He said, well, as you can see, I'm a real simple, humble person, Mr. Blazer. But my wife and my daughter have much bigger dreams and ambitions than I do. And I just want to give them everything in life that they deserve. And I was like, whoa. Like, oof. This guy would do anything and go to hell and back for the two people he loves in the world more than anything else. I said, man, you come back here Monday morning, I'm going to take a big chance on you, and I'll give you the opportunity of a lifetime. So seeing the environment he was in, you think he would have dressed up a little bit? Not, and he shows up the same way. And so we're sitting here, and I'm looking at him, and I'm like, maybe you made a mistake on this one. How is this guy going to get on a phone talking to big-time people and convince them to write checks for hundreds of thousands of dollars? The guy looks like Joe Dirt. And I said, follow me. Put him in my sports car. I took him to a department store. I invested in his future. I treated him to two suits that day. Took him to my barber, said, I got to give this dude a Hollywood makeover. Came into the office, 4:30, secretary didn't even recognize him as the same guy. The next morning, man, the guy's walking in. He's got some swag. He's feeling good, right? Because I changed his persona, showed him the script, showed him what we do. That year, Joe Dirt raised $25 million and earned $250,000 in commission.
Wow.
So I tell people, if I can teach Joe Dirt how to raise $25 million, I can teach most anybody that has a desire that follows the blueprint. That's a true story.
Wow. And what do you think it was? Obviously, the story about his family is really inspiring. What do you think it was about him that allowed him to excel, right?
I think it was a couple things. You know, one, it's just the system. I mean, we have a proven system. And it works. We have literally hundreds of testimonials, people that have raised, you know, all various amounts of money. I think the other thing was largely just his work ethic. You know, the guy showed up in the morning. He worked, you know, until 5, 6 o'clock. And it was really, for him, just creating systems and the structure and saying, you know, hey, here's what you do. Here's how you follow up. Here's how you move people forward in this process. Because people always ask me, like, you know, is this going to work? I'm like, I guarantee, yes, 100% it will work. And they're like, well, sounds good. But here's the secret. It will not work for the people that don't do the work. Like, people sign up for my coaching program, and I get on my weekly calls, and I'm looking for them, and they never show up. And I'm like, dude, you spent $5,000 to hire me as a consultant and a mentor, and you're not even showing up on the weekly calls. I can check my online platform. You haven't even created an account. And then you're going to blame me that this don't work? Like, I'm calling the kettle black here.
Yeah.
Like, you haven't even showed up. And then they want a refund. I'm like, there are no refunds after 30 days.
Yeah, especially if you didn't log in.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, and I get all the proof. And, of course, we win probably 90% of our disputes. But the point is, money just doesn't show up in a wheelbarrow.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I'm teaching you a system. I'm teaching you how to raise capital. But if you just expect it to happen, it ain't going to happen. It's like anything else in life. You got to do the work. And most people don't want to do the work. I mean, you know, when I go to the fitness center and I see people with six-pack abs or they're fit, I know that shit takes work.
Yeah.
You just don't wake up and all of a sudden
have six. You can't pay the gym membership. You don't go to the gym. You're like, the gym doesn't work.
Yeah. But it's like, you know, if I hire a math tutor for my kid and my kid gets a C, do I blame the tutor? No, I blame my kid because more than likely my kid didn't do the homework.
Yeah.
So I always tell people, look, you got to look at yourself in the mirror and ask yourself, are you going to do the work that we outline to raise potentially millions of dollars and create a legacy for you and your family? Or are you going to be one of these people that just is a slacker that's going to acquiesce, stay stuck where you are because you want, quote, the easy way? And this ain't easy. It does take work. But at the end of the day, it is a proven system that we teach. You know, we got the blueprint. I mean, Jordan Belfort, who I love, was using something very similar. to build his entire business. We all know rags to riches story there. Obviously, he did some things wrong, but what he taught a lot of registered reps and brokers how to do was to get on the phone, raise millions of dollars, create the urgency in the eyes of the investor. And so, you know, if you do it the right way, you can have tremendous success. Yeah.
Can you break down what does a real estate deal look like with this model, right? I'm 21 years old. I'm fresh out of college or high school or whatever it is, and I want to start building and putting together real estate deals. What would that first deal look like?
So understand, you know, when you're in real estate, there's what we call a syndication, where you have like one property and you're syndicating it out, you're bringing in investors, and then you have a fund where you're going to raise a lot more money, and then that fund might invest in multiple properties. But typically, in a real estate deal, you know, the investors are taking most of the risk. They're putting up most of the money. And so typically what you might want to say to the investor is, look, we're going to buy this property, or we're going to, you know, buy this building, and I'm going to give you, you know, 70% of all the upside. And because I'm the one doing most of the work, I'm going to get 30%. Because it's generating cash flow, and, you know, we're collecting rent, we pay the taxes, we pay the insurance, but there's some money left at the end of the month, you're going to get an 8% preferred distribution. If we do better, you know, we might make some special distributions. But what I always do is I tell students, design a deal where you have what we call a pref. You tell the investor, before we get paid, you got to make this pref, 8%, whatever it is, 7%. Anything above that, we mutually share based on this sharing agreement. But if we get to returns of 12% or greater, then my interest goes from 30 to 40. Yours goes from 70 now to 60. And so you can see I'm incentivized to do really good and generate great returns. And structure in a real estate deal, you know, can vary from deal to deal, or, you know, from one sector to another. But when you're an entrepreneur and a business owner, you have to decide, am I comfortable giving up some of the upside or some of the equity? Or do I just want to, you know, pay interest and just borrow the money and have a note where I say, look, you know, you give me $100,000, I'm going to pay you X, and at the end of 3 years, you're going to get all your money back. Some people that are in retirement, they're fine with that. Like, you know, if a guy's 65 and he's on fixed income, he's got Social Security, and he's not a risk taker, you say, look, you know, I'm going to give you 9% a year. He's like, yeah, that's great. Like, I can't get that anywhere else. I'm happy. And if you're going to give me my money back at the end of 3 years, I'll probably just reinvest it with you again. The younger people are trying to grow wealth, and they're like, nah, I want to see my money grow, so I need some of that upside. But, you know, structuring a deal is really more about just understanding the market, looking at your competitors, seeing what everybody else is doing, and just kind of going from there.
Got it. So in that scenario, the fund manager or the person that's raising the capital, right? They're incentivized to make the deal profitable. Yep. And they're also incentivized to work with private investors because then they don't have to go to a bank. They're hypothetically maybe getting a better rate than what a bank might give, right?
Absolutely.
They can buy the properties potentially in cash, right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. There's a lot of real estate, what we call operators, syndicators, issuers, that will raise money from investors, and they'll literally buy a property for cash. There's no debt because they're very risk averse. They don't want that potential risk that, you know, something's going to happen where they have a lender that can foreclose. And so there are a lot of companies out there that I actually am very familiar with that, you know, have billion-dollar portfolios, all cash, no debt, no mortgage. And it's a very safe model. There's others, obviously, that, you know, might raise 20, 25%. They go get, you know, Fannie Mae or whatever. They buy the asset. They're making mortgage payments. And then they either plan to refinance or, you know, do something. But you got to look at the real estate industry and realize it's cyclical. You know, we're at a point now where, you know, interest rates have obviously gone up, right? You know, real estate prices have obviously softened and gone down, but there's a disconnect because a lot of sellers still have that euphoric memory of where prices were a year, year and a half ago, and they don't want to come off that price. And then you have the buyers that are like, man, I can't make the numbers work because what used to be 3% is now 7 or 8%. It'll eventually reach equilibrium, but there's such a buying opportunity out there in the marketplace. Like, I was called on a deal about 9 months ago, big Toronto real estate firm. They manage billions of dollars. They know me, say, hey, Brad, we We know you're in Houston. We're buying a trophy asset. Like, when you look at commercial real estate, we give them a letter. You know, it's a D property, which is a piece of shit. C, B, B plus, and then A is considered, like, great. This was above an A. This is, like, institutional shit. Like, I'm talking a 34-story building, major market in Houston called Greenway Plaza. The building fucking has a name called Phoenix Tower. I'm talking trophy. And they're like, yeah. The replacement value is about $850 million. We're buying it for $110 from a very distressed seller at a 9.1 cap. And I'm like, a 9 cap? Like, you don't see stuff like this trade at a 9 cap. You're lucky to buy it, like, at a 4 cap. And, you know, a cap rate is an indication of value. And I'm like, send me the stuff, you know. And I took a look at it. We raised some money. We invested alongside this big operator. But, you know, when you look at stuff like that and you realize that there's distress in the market because a lot of people that bought real estate at these very low rates had floating rate debt. And so as the rates went up, so did their payments. Mm-hmm. But the income from the tenants that pay rent didn't go up fast enough. And so you have a lot of these big, huge billion-dollar companies like, you know, Starwood, that are distressed, that literally have to look at their portfolio and say, okay, we've owned this property over here a long time. We're going to sell it at such a low price where the investors are not going to make what we've anticipated, but they're not going to lose money. You know, they'll get 3-4% a year. But we got to take our profits to pay the debt on these other two properties, or we're going to lose them too. And so you're seeing a lot of that right now in the real estate space. And it's a very opportunistic space for people that have access to capital. So if you know how to raise capital, you're going to get some really great deals. That's just the truth. There's going to be some great, great deals over the next 12 to 18 months because that is going to continue.
So the person who's raising the capital, mm-hmm. right, since they're not actually putting financial, they're basically putting in sweat equity, right? Do they end up getting ownership in the properties as well?
Oh, you bet. Absolutely. Yeah. When you structure the deal, and the way that we do ours, of course, is we structure it as an LLC so that we have that the corporate protection. But most people are familiar with what we call a GP and an LP. GP is a general partner. That's you, or that's me. And then you got the investors that are the LPs. The reason that we don't like to structure our deals as partnerships is that as a GP, I take on personal liability. But when you do it as an LLC, it's almost exactly the same. You are the sponsor, the issuer, and I'm the investor. But because you're doing the lifting and you're doing the heavy work, yeah, you're going to have some ownership. And so typically you're going to say, look, investors, I get 40% ownership. You get the other 60. And so when we sell this property, the first thing is I'm going to give you all your principal back. So you put in 100, here's 100,000. Thank you very much. Then we're going to look back over the life of the investment. And I told you that, you know, you have this preferred return. So we're going to look at every year. And any year that you did not earn the preferred, whether it was 7 or 8, we're going to make up that difference. Everything else, you get 70, I get 30. Or, you know, if we generate returns above this particular number, 12%, then I get 40 and you get 60. So when you look at the opportunity to raise money and go out and maybe buy a...
Because you're competing, essentially, when you're raising capital, you're competing with the bank, yeah. You're competing with the stock market. Yeah. You're competing with crypto. You're competing with every other thing that investor could invest their money and deploy their capital to.
But here's the secret.
Now I can get 5% from a savings account or whatever. Correct. So you're competing with 5%. So you got to give at least 8 correct. To make the investor pay attention, right?
But here's the big secret. This is where the math and really where an understanding of real estate economics makes sense. The one thing that real estate has that banks don't have, a lot of investments have, is tax benefits. Mm. See, investors in real estate look for 3 things: cash flow, upside appreciation, and tax benefits. Depreciation. So if I'm giving you an 8% distribution, are you paying taxes and all of that distribution? Fuck no, because I'm passing through the depreciation, and now I may be sheltering 30% of that. So we talk about something called the pre-tax equivalent yield in real estate, where I say we're going to be paying you 8%. But it's the equivalent of you getting 11 or 12, depending on the bracket you're in.
Yeah.
Which means you'd have to find a competing investment paying you 11%, good luck with that, to be equivalent to me giving you 8, because even though I'm giving you 8, you're not paying tax on 30% of that. And so when you look at real estate, and especially commercial, there are things like cost segregation, where I tell you, look, you know, there's mechanical components in the building, like the HVAC system. and the appliances and, you know, the elevator, if it's a multi-story property, that has a 7-year depreciation schedule. The rest of the structure has 27 and a half, so we can accelerate the depreciation and give you more of a tax benefit. And the investor's like, I don't get that in my CD, or I don't get that in the stock market. No, you're paying taxes on all of your earnings. And so whenever we talk to potential investors about investing with us, in our deck, we have slides that say, let me talk to you now about the tax benefits, because that's a huge part of why people invest in real estate. I mean, look at Trump. Trump didn't pay any taxes. Why? Because the dude has hundreds of millions of dollars in real estate. And, you know, I was making very high six figures, just under seven figures a year. My CPA called me, said, congratulations, your effective tax bracket is 3%. You're paying $18,000 on almost $1 million of earnings.
Wow.
I mean, people are in the 40% tax bracket paying $400 or $500 because they don't have the real estate that I do. And so when you understand that, you understand the value of investing in real estate and how the depreciation and the ability to write off all of the things like the taxes, the insurance, the you know, the work you do. If I go out there and I make repairs, all that repair is deductible. It's a cost of doing business. All that stuff passes through to the investors. And so that's part of the structure, but it's also what I call part of the story. Because most people that are going to invest with you are not sophisticated investors. And so you really have to dumb it down. It's what I call the old KISS principle. Keep it simple for those that are stupid. But if you explain it as a school teacher and say, let me break this down and make this as simple as I can for you, Tony, then you're like, oh, that makes sense to me. I get it. And so you write out your check for whatever amount, $100,000 or $200,000. You're now part of my family. I hug you and I say, we're going to take good care of you. And you see that the investment is performing because you're getting your check every quarter or you're getting your check every month. And then I sell it. And you're like, shit, I gave him $100,000. I'm getting $180,000 back and I got all the tax benefits. Let's do it again. And that's how you scale and you build what I call a huge real estate syndication company. I mean, we got people in our community. You met one of them. Medina's got almost $500 million, dude.
Wow.
In real estate. Most of it's been raised from investors. Yeah.
That's incredible. And so that kind of leads me to my next question. So the investors that typically you teach your students to get to invest, you said, you know, they may not be the most sophisticated. Are you targeting like family offices, like ultra high net worth people, people in the middle? Like what's the average net worth of like the people that you go after and where do you find them? How do you find them?
So it's a great question. In my personal career, I've raised money from every source you can fathom. I've raised money from what we call retail investors. You know, these are doctors, business owners, people that live amongst us in our communities. I've raised money from family offices, broker dealers, sovereign wealth funds, institutions like insurance companies. So when someone comes to me, I can teach them anything that they want to know, or I can teach at any level that they want to grow to, because I've done all of that stuff. Most other coaches have not done half of that. You usually start with just what we call retail investors. You know, hey, let's get some doctors, let's get some entrepreneurs, let's get people that, you know, can put in a 50, 100,000. But a lot of the students that come to me are like, look, I've already raised 50 million. Like I've already been successful. I want to learn how to raise money, Brad, from family offices, or I want to build distribution from broker dealers. So now I have broker dealers raising money for me and I can raise 100 million in a fund. Great. I can teach you how to do that because I personally have done that and I've worked for companies where I was the head of capital markets. But what most people do is they grow in their career, just like getting a job and growing and getting an advance. So you start with investors, then you might grow to family offices, then you might grow to build distribution with broker dealers, then you might grow to raise money from institutions. So as you raise more money and you say to yourself, okay, I want to raise $100 million this year, but if I'm working with just individual investors, it's going to take a long time because the average investment is $50,000 or $100,000. I need to figure out how can I get people to physically write checks for $5 and $10 million. Because now raising $100 is much more realistic if my average investment is $5 to $10 million. It's very unrealistic if my average check is $50 to $100 unless I have a lot of broker dealers that are raising that money for me. So one of the things that we're real good at in our community is looking at people and saying, okay, where are you now? That's what I call your plan A or your point A. Where do you want to be? And then we figure out how to get there in as efficient manner as possible. Like for Medina, he said, Brad, I want to be worth $2 billion in about 2 to 3 years. Great. How much do you have now? $400 million? How long has it taken you? 7 years. So it's taking you 7 years to go from zero to four, and you want to be at $2 billion in 2 years. Yeah. You realize if you do what you've done, you're not going to be anywhere close to that. Yeah, that's why I'm talking to you. I said, we need to get broker dealers to raise all the money for you. Then I can get you to $2 billion quick. He said, great. So he's been to all the big events. We're doing the right things. He's having conversations with broker dealers. And I have all those relationships because I've worked in that space for many, many years. And so, you know, he'll be at $2 billion or more, just knowing his psyche and the fact that the guy likes to go from zero to 60 about as quick as he can. But that's the beautiful thing about the Capital School community and platform. We have people at various levels. We have different mentors. And we got a guy like myself who's literally raised money at the highest levels for some of the biggest firms in the world.
That's incredible. Yeah. Let's touch on quickly, if you can, like mergers and acquisitions. Mm-hmm. That's another strategy, right? Basically doing roll-ups, right?
Yeah.
Taking a bunch of small companies, putting them together. When I first moved to Puerto Rico, I met a billionaire. And I always talk about Puerto Rico. It's almost like living in a giant mastermind because you have all these cool people from all around the world that move to Puerto Rico for the tax benefits. Fun fact, in Puerto Rico, landlords pay no tax. Mm. There's been this law that they keep extending every couple of years where there's no tax on rental income.
Wow.
For landlords there. And there's a bunch of other tax benefits, 0% capital gains for the investors that move down. But so I met a billionaire when I was in my first year living there, and I helped him get set up on the island, and he was in the middle of doing a roll-up. So he purchased medical medical facilities that did testing for cancer and things of that nature. And the law in the medical industry was that they needed to be owned primarily by the doctors. Mm-hmm. So how he got around that is he took a 49% stake in all of these different medical testing facilities, rolled them up into a conglomerate, and then ended up having an exit, I think, for like $700 million or something crazy. Yeah. When you're raising money for roll-ups and for mergers and acquisitions, how is that different structuring those deals than for real estate? And what advice do you have for people that are trying to get into that world of?
Yeah, I mean, it's largely the same. I mean, I've got a student, Nicholas, in Vegas, and you know, he started with us in January about a year and a half ago, and in the first 3 months of the year, he raised $6 million. And all he was doing is basically using that money to buy businesses. And so his whole thing is business acquisitions, businesses in Vegas, and putting them in a holding company. And so it's largely just, you know, the same as real estate, looking at the business, looking at the numbers, and underwriting it, and then just figuring out, you know, what type of a return you can give to an investor to make it worth somebody else's while to invest with you. But the thing that I will tell you is you can raise money for just about anything. So we have students in our community that are raising money for the entertainment space, Broadway shows, doing movies. We got people that are raising money, obviously, for real estate, you know, just buying and flipping houses, you know, building a rental portfolio, getting into multifamily or storage or, you know, retail. We got people over here that are buying Amazon e-commerce businesses. We got people over here that have developed a product like a new type of microphone, and they need to get it into distribution and create a prototype. And so it doesn't really matter what it is you're raising capital for. It's just following the system and the blueprint and having the proper tools, i.e. a presentation, or we call it a pitch deck, an executive summary, or depending on the amount, what we call a private placement memorandum, maybe a web presence, and just having the right things to show investors what it is you're doing, how the investment's going to work, how they're going to get their money back. But, you know, when you look at a whole community of people around the world in different countries and with different strategies and realize this guy's successful, this guy's successful, this lady's successful, this, you know that your system works. And it gets back to what I said earlier. The reason the system works is it's built on concepts. Like, you know, the trust sequence is a six-step process that teaches people how to build trust with somebody else. So the very first thing is perception. The second an investor meets you, he's in his mind deciding if there's ever going to be a second date with you. Mm. And then you get to the second step, which is temptation. You're going to ask the person questions. When you invest, what is it you're looking for? What's your time horizon? Tell me about your best investment. And so you listen, and really what that person's telling you is what you need to know so that later in the relationship, you can sell them on the investment by saying, I remember when we were first talking, you said that you wanted your money to grow because you have a young child. and you want to be able to put that kid through school. Can you see how this investment's going to help you do that, Tony? Yeah, great. Let's do this. You know, but if you weren't paying attention or you weren't uncovering the temptation, you now cannot tape the features of the investment to the benefits for that other person. So I teach people a lot of psychology. You were asking earlier, like, what does it take to be a successful customer? A lot of it is just understanding the sales process, understanding you got to close, understanding how the mind processes information. Because the biggest secret about raising money is to come across to the investor as if you don't need it. Cool, calm, and collected. Some will, some won't. So what? Who's next? Because nobody wants to invest money with someone that comes across as overly desperate. And so in this process, the big thing I try to teach people is, look, tell that investor multiple times in the first and second conversation, right now, I just don't have an investment that I can discuss with you. I wish I did, but the reason I don't is because I always like to give right of first refusal to my existing investors. And so when I have a new project or a new deal, they tend to fill up pretty quickly. But here's what I'd love to do. I keep a list of people on my desk that have expressed interest, and I'd love to put your name on that list. So in the event I have an opening on something I think you can get excited about at some point in the future, I can give you a call. How does that sound? And when they say, yeah, please do that, really what they're saying is, I trust you enough to move forward in this process to consider doing something with you. Please call me. They're not coming out and saying it that way, but the subliminal subconscious saying yes is...
Yeah, they're making that small commitment.
It's, you know? Yeah, exactly. It's a trial close.
Yeah.
And so you have to understand, and this is, we spend a lot of time coaching and consulting, is this is a process. But if you follow the concepts and you use the tools and the resources, you can potentially raise millions of dollars like many of our people do. Yeah.
Yeah. And you're playing the long game, right? You're building relationships. Yep. And then you're building essentially a war chest of relationships that, if you are, again, a good steward of the money, you get a return on investment for your investors. You can then go back to them in the future.
Oh, absolutely.
With any deal.
It just gets easier and easier and easier the longer you do this. Like, I've got friends that have been raising money 3 years that, you know, go out and buy a $25, $30 million apartment building. They need to raise $6 to $8 million to close it. And I'm like, how long did it take you to raise the money? 10 days. Because they get the network. They've got the investor database. They just send out an email. Put me down for 150, Brad. Great. Put me down for 200. Great. And so, you know, in a week and a half, you get the commitments and you have your capital call and you're done. You can't do that when you're getting started. But the great thing about it is, if, like you said, you do the work, you treat them fairly, you're totally transparent, you now get to the very last stage in that trust sequence that I was just talking about. We call that affiliation. They start to open up their network to help you, because now you can go back to that person and say, who are you connected with that I should also be talking to? And the person goes, you know, my friend Bobby just sold the business, or I go golfing every week with my friend Steve. And so, great, would you be more than happy to introduce me or to send an email? No, I'd be more than happy. And so you start leveraging other people's networks. Well, guess what? It becomes even more easier. Because now that person that's connected to one of your investors is like, well, if he trusts you and he's done well, yeah, I'm interested. Tell me what you're doing here. You know, just like when we were in the Dominican, we had a lot of people there that were what? Brought in through the relationships of other people. And so that's really the secret to raising capital. It's just, you know, do right by other people. Be totally honest and transparent. But more importantly, follow a proven system and just keep moving people through a process. You know, Grant Cardone, whether you love him or hate him, has a phrase, and it's very true. Money follows motion. So I meet you. You like me, I meet you. I move you forward in a process. Hey, join me next week, Tony. I'm doing a free webinar on the tax benefits of investing in real estate. Follow up a couple days. How'd you like the webinar? Great. You know, hey, we don't have a deal right now. And so you're just moving people forward. Finally, when you have a deal, you pitch the guy, he says, yeah, send me the stuff. You send him everything, and then you close him on the next call by answering questions and then just saying, you know, how much of this do you see yourself taking? Are you comfortable doing 50? Do you see yourself doing more like 100? Can you see yourself doing 200? Like, what's comfortable with you? And usually the person says, I don't know, like, tell me what $150,000 looks like. This is what it looks like. Is that something you're comfortable with? Yeah, I can do that. Great, let's go to the paperwork and get you signed up. That's how you raise money.
I love it. What I know we're running out of time. What final advice do you have if you could go back in time and maybe give some advice to the younger version of yourself?
Oh, geez. You know, probably the best advice I can give to anybody, especially the young up-and-comers, is get started as early as you can. You know, so many people try to say, oh, I'm going to wait for the right opportunity, or, you know, I don't have the money. Find the fucking money. You know, I tell my students that want to sign up that say, oh, I can't do it right now. I'm like, look, if the transmission in your car fucking gave out tomorrow and you needed that mode of transportation to go to work, I guarantee you'd find the money somehow, some way. Is this as important to you in changing your life as getting, you know, your transmission fixed? Yes. Great. Then let's touch base in 3 days and you figure out how to find the money. Because there's a difference between, I think, what is interest and intent. Everybody in the world has an interest in raising money. Let's face it.
Yeah.
It's how intentional, though, are you in taking the action to actually do it. It's one thing to say, yeah, I'm interested, but it's another thing to say I'm intentional and I'm going to do it and take the actions to physically now do it. But, you know, the thing is really is just, you know, you got to get started. Because I was talking to a guy the other day, his name was Abdul, and he said, I'm going to do this. I'm like, great, send him all the information. He sent me an email, so I'm going to wait till January. And I said, why are you going to wait till January when we just had a conversation last week? Do you not realize that October, November, December are the best capital raising months in the entire year? I sent him a chart, third party credibility that showed this fucking chart going ballistic in September, October. Why? Because big executives are getting the year end bonuses. Like, I fucking got a bonus. I work on Wall Street. I got a $100,000 bonus. What am I going to do with it? Or their CPAs are sitting down going, hey, man, you're paying a lot more in taxes this year. You need to look for some investments that provide tax relief. Guess what? Real estate. So I'm like, you're foregoing the best 3 months of the year. You want to wait to January? Like, you're doing yourself a disservice. Guy's still on the fence. I don't have any idea why. Maybe just doesn't have the money to move forward. But the big thing is just get started because it compounds just like money. You know, if you want to wait 5 years and start your capital raising, great. But imagine how far along you could be if you started earlier and just allowed that money to grow. You know, because I was talking to, you remember Mike, the guy that was in Houston,
yeah,
right here?
Another real estate guy.
This guy's built a very successful real estate business. You know, it's worth millions. But he said, I've never raised a dime from an investor. And I want to learn how to do it because I realize going forward, if I learn this skill, I can accelerate and go much further and get there much faster than me doing it on my own. And that's the secret. I tell people, look, I try to break down barriers and turn them into breakthroughs. I try to take decades and turn them into days. And if you understand the OPM game, like Robert Kiyosaki said in the book Rich Dad, it is the secret to creating legacy wealth. Because if you're getting, let's just say, 40% of a real estate portfolio where you borrow the money, and it's now, you know, 20 million, 40%, it's $8 million. But that real estate portfolio is going up every year. So when you have a liquidity event where you're selling off that real estate and you're sitting there and you're getting these huge, you know, multiple six-figure, potentially seven-figure checks, that's life-changing money. You're making more in one transaction than you might have made working 3 to 5 years. And if you are a good steward of that money and you invest it wisely back into real estate, or you do a 1031 where you defer the taxes, man, you're creating legacy wealth for yourself and your family. So the big secret, if I would go back and tell myself, is just, man, I wish I would have started earlier. That's the God's honest truth.
Yeah. Yeah, and it reminds me of another quote from one of mentors of mine. And this is a famous quote. I mean, he didn't invent it, but
reinvented it.
Reinvented it.
Made it better.
But you know, they say if you wanna go fast, you go alone. But if you wanna go far, you go with others, right?
Yeah.
And so it's really the raising capital game is really the long game of building relationships with investors, and also the long game of, hey, my business, whether it's real estate investing or any other type of business, it can go farther and longer with capital outside investment, right?
Yeah.
Like there's tons of benefits, and hats off to everybody that wants to bootstrap everything. And yeah, that's in the last decade or so, it's become cool to say, hey, bootstrap. And that's great to get you to the first step. I definitely, you know, I think you'll get the respect of a lot of investors to say, hey, I bootstrapped this far, but now I want to go farther.
Yeah.
And the only way to go farther is to get OPM, other people's money.
Right? I agree. You know, I do a lot of speaking all around the world. And, of course, you know, I got my show and share the stage with some great, great leaders and educators. And I always get a laugh. And I say, we got a big problem with most of the people in this room. And I say, a lot of you hear the rumor on a very powerful drug. It's more powerful than heroin. It's much more powerful than anything you could ever put in your body. And the name of that drug is hopium. See, hopium is the hope that your situation is going to change. You might win the lottery. You might get a raise. You might get lucky and come into some money. So you're hoping that your condition will get better. And you can hope forever. 9 out of 10 times, it doesn't change. So we can have this conversation today, or I can call you back in a year, and more than likely you're going to be in exactly the same place in 12 months that you are here. There's a much better drug, and it's called opium, other people's money. And so once you understand that and you get into that game, now shit changes, because now you're able to do big deals. Now you're able to go out there and do stuff that you weren't able to do 6 to 9 months ago. And the God's honest truth is literally, it does not take long to start getting your first investors on board. Like, I have a guy, he's a student of ours, works for an oil company. He literally tracked this. He cold calls just off a list of people that he buys. So he's getting a list of high net worth people, cold calling. He's making probably 100 calls a day, you know. And July 28th, he cold called a guy. Didn't know who he was. I mean, he's like, you know, just send me the stuff. I'll take a look at it. The first week of September, $200,000. That's roughly what, from almost August 1st to the first week? That's almost 4.5, maybe 5 weeks. From a guy that he has no relationship with to $200,000. And he documented every call, and he said, look, it took me 5 weeks to go from 0 to 60, $200,000 in the bank. And then that wasn't the first investment. He'd been raising money before, but he wanted to see how long my system took to get a win. And so I tell people, look, this isn't like a 6 to 9 to 12 month thing to start getting money in the door. Like, I can teach you the system so that literally in 2 to 3 months, you're getting money coming in, and that money's just scaling and growing because you're just replicating that same system. And you're basically just, you know, after you get your first one, your believability factor goes up, like, this shit actually works. Then you get a third investor, then a fifth. And before you know it, you're like, wow, you got a database of 20 investors, because all you're doing is you're rinsing and repeating that same process. But that's how you build your investor network. And that's how you get a database that when you get a big deal in 3 years, you just send out an email, boom, it's done.
Love that. Yeah. I have like one last question, kind of more on the technical side of things and the strategy side. So it sounds like you've created this amazing system to bring in investors into deals, mm-hmm. right? But now what about the back end? How do you ensure that your students who are raising this capital are able to deliver mm-hmm. on the return on investment for them? And what principles and advice do you have so that they can be a good steward of that investor money, right?
Yeah.
Like, should they just, like, go out and buy a Lambo as soon as they get the first person to invest with them? Yeah. Or should they wait for the Lambo and do something else?
Well, I always believe in, you know, deferred gratification. But believe it or not, there are investor portals. There are platforms that give investors access that do a lot of those analytics.
Provide the transparency. Yeah.
Do a lot of that reporting. You know, certainly you should have a local accounting firm that's, you know, looking at the tax information, sending out the K-1s. You know, hopefully you got a securities attorney. If not, you can leverage our relationships. We work with 3 different law firms and stuff that can do the legal work for you.
So essentially, the investor doesn't only have to trust the person that's starting the fund and raising the money, because you're going to lean on the credibility
absolutely.
Of a law firm, independent third party, an accounting firm, independent third party,
correct.
And other software and transparency tools to
correct.
Make sure.
Or you know, or somebody that's very experienced and very seasoned that has a knowledge of the industry. For example, when you're raising money from investors, especially accredited investors, the Securities and Exchange Commission does not have a rule or a mandate that says you need to have a private placement memorandum. There's nothing out there that says you even need one. So people are like, well, then why am I spending, you know, $20,000, $30,000 to hire a law firm to create a private placement memorandum if technically I don't need one? The answer is that becomes your insurance policy. You see, when you're raising money from investors and you're investing in business or real estate, we all know things can go wrong. And all the best underwriting and all the best of intentions get thrown out of the window when there's something like a hurricane or a natural disaster or just, change in tax laws that take away the incentives. So your private placement document is nothing more than a complete risk disclosure document. You put every conceivable risk in there and give it to the investor and say, here's our private placement memorandum, and it has all of these disclaimers, and this is why you should not invest. Now if something happens, it's very challenging for that person to come back and sue you or hold you liable, where you can say, look, we told you that was one of the potential risks. So the private placement memorandum is not like a big marketing document. No, it's your protection as you're raising capital by providing disclosure. But the funny thing about, raising capital from investors is you want to be transparent. You want to be honest. You don't want to try to hide anything or not disclose what we call a material fact. Because in the securities industry, you can be held liable of failing to disclose what we call a material fact that may have led somebody to make a different decision. So, for example, if you had filed bankruptcy 6 years ago, and I'm looking at potentially investing with you, do you think that maybe failing to conceal the fact that you had a bankruptcy might convince me to make a different decision?
Yeah.
And so, in your memorandum, you have to disclose that. So now if I do invest and I find out at a later date, you didn't tell me that. Oh, it was right here in the memorandum. Did you not read the memorandum? See, the burden is on the investor to read the memorandum. Now, most of the time they don't. That's just reality because it's a big, lengthy document. But you gave it to them and the disclosure was right there. So that's kind of what we do in the world of raising money, is really just provide full disclosure. And that's why these documents are so very important, to make sure that when you go into this relationship and you shake their hand and they give you their money, that at the end of the day, you're somewhat protected. Now, you certainly can still be sued, but the majority of the time you'll prevail if you have a well-written document that really protects you.
Got it. So I have one last question. This is a question we ask all our guests, and that is, what does disrupt mean to you?
Oh, I love that. Man, what does disrupt mean to me? Disrupt means that you're doing something different. Yeah, and more importantly, people are taking notice. You look at what I call the traditional ways of doing things, and you kind of come in and you just completely disrupt it. And by disrupting it, you make a loud noise, you get people's attention. You really are doing something much, much bigger with your life, with other people's lives. And you look at some of the biggest entrepreneurs in the world that have disrupted. Elon Musk disrupted the automotive industry. And look at where he is today, right? He's not only disrupted that, he's also disrupted the space industry with SpaceX, and now his Boring company, where he's, providing highways underground. So when you look at people that have the ability to disrupt, they're winners. They're risk takers. And I love the word, and I love what it stands for, and I love what you guys are doing with the magazine and everything else. But what I would tell entrepreneurs is, don't cave in to do what you see everybody else doing. The big problem with our educational system today is our university system is largely designed to do one thing, and that is to teach you how to go out in the world and conform. We live in a society of conformance. Get a job, save a little bit of money, put some money in your 401k, and hopefully someday you'll be able to retire. 67% of our fucking people are dead-ass broke, and I see fucking people in their 80s working at Walmart. That system of our university education is obviously not working. So when you look at disrupting and realizing, well, if that's not working and I see my parents not rich and I want to be rich, I got to do something different. So let me disrupt conformity. And that's what disrupt stands for. It is really just basically living life in a non-conforming manner because you realize what everybody else is doing is not working.
I love it. If people want to connect with you on social media, they want to follow up with you, where's the best places to do that?
So on Instagram, it's just Brad Blazer. And it's a little blue check thing that tells you you're dealing with me and not a follower or somebody that decided to come up with some fake account. But my name is spelled Blazer, B-L-A-Z-A-R. There's no E's in the spelling of my first or last name. It's bradblazer.com. Website, same thing, bradblazer.com. On Amazon, if you're interested in my books, my book Winning at the Capital Game, which has been shipped all over the world, endorsed by Kevin Harrington, one of the sharks, You just go to Amazon and just put in Brad Blazer, and all three of my books will come up. You can buy one, or you can buy the whole bundle. But we're real easy to find. You put my name in Google, and I show up everywhere. I'll show up on your podcast with the other hundreds that I've been on. I'll show up, you know, on TV shows. Yeah, real easy to track down. But, you know, if you want to get on a call, we give everybody a free strategy call. You know, let's find out what you want to do. Find out how we can help you. Maybe it's something simple like, hey, here's my free copy of my book, or come to one of the boot camps to really just kind of take a look under the hood. We'd love to work with your listeners and see how we can help them learn how to raise capital. That's what we do.
I love it. Brad Blazer, thank you so much again for being on the show, my friend.
I appreciate it.